four, a planned four at any rate. Last week we started out by talking about risk versus risk and how you deal with a situation in which you want to take one risk in order to avoid another one, how you choose which risk to take, and we're going to resume that today. And then from there, after we take care of that, I want to move into a conversation about compelling people to vaccinate. And the question of saying, well, even if you don't feel you need it, maybe you should take it anyway for the sake of others, for the sake of the community. There's a lot to be said, obviously, in this regard. As has been pointed out, we have a lot of sources on the sheet. Some of the sources are shorter, some of the sources are longer. And we'll get through whatever we get through. But thank you very much for joining for this morning. As usual, I expect to send out a follow-up email later with the link to the recording. So if you miss anything, if you just want to hear it again, greatest hits, by all means, you'll be able to do so. People have asked me about sharing it with other people. Totally fine, of course. I want to thank the following people who made donations to my Beit Midrash's Day of Giving back in July and dedicated a class, and their donations are associated with this class. Rabbi Alex and Judith Hecht, Avram Lubavitch, and Ari and Dr. Graciela Perez. Okay, so we talked about the issue of, as we said, accepting one risk in order to avoid a different risk. And the issue here is that any medical intervention whatsoever involves some level of risk. But on the other hand, not engaging in the intervention is also risky, right? That's true with everything. A person says, well, heart surgery is risky, but going without heart surgery can also be risky. So taking a vaccine may entail some level of risk, but not taking the vaccine and being vulnerable to the illness you're trying to avoid, again, is a matter of risk. So what we said last time was that we gave two approaches to gauging risk versus risk. The first was maybe one of the risks is so low that we're able to disregard it. In other words, there are risks that are considered to be negligible. Right? Like we said, the fact that you go to work, the fact that you get out of bed in the morning, right? You may be aware getting out of bed causes a shift in your blood pressure. So maybe that's a risk also. Watching the news causes a shift in your blood pressure. That's a risk as well. So, you know, we take certain risks. Maybe some of them we shouldn't take. But the point is that it's recognized that certain risks are so low that they're not a concern. Rabbi Herschel Schachter, a Rebbe of mine, wrote in an article, or was quoted in an article, I should say, that if a person says, I am concerned about something that nobody else is concerned with, there's a one in a million risk, and everybody else engages in the activity all the time, and he says, I'm personally concerned, we don't view that as significant in Jewish law. Meaning, the fact that you're worried, but absolutely nobody else on the planet is worried, doesn't make it a significant risk. So that's one possibility. You weigh one risk against the other, and you say, if one of them is just insignificant, we're going to discount it. The second approach that we offered was to say, cost-benefit. What is the projected cost if you ignore one of the risks? So, in other words, instead of saying this risk is really low, neither risk is infinitesimal. Neither risk is negligible. However, one of the risks is a greater one than the other. It comes with a greater cost than the other. So, for example, going back to the case of going to work, so the risk involved in going to work may indeed be a significant risk, but the risk of not having a job and starving is a greater risk. So therefore you say, you know what, I need to take on this risk, even though this risk is actually significant. And that was a second approach. The third approach to balancing risk, and this is the last one in the set, is to me the most fascinating and the hardest to quantify. And that is the question of, is one risk a near-term risk and the other one a far-away risk, a distant risk? Risks that are farther away have less significance in Jewish law. If you take a look at source number one on the sheet, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, a great rabbi in 19th century Germany, is addressing a case in which he says, where there is a concern for a future danger, we take it much less seriously. Just look at the last line in the source. I'm not going to go through the full source right now. There are too many other things that we need to see. But he says, if this weren't true, that we're willing to discount a further away risk, he says, how could one enter the sea or go into the wilderness, activities for which we thank God when we are saved? What I mentioned last week about Berkat HaGomel, the fact that there's a blessing to say after having engaged in a dangerous activity and surviving it, he says, who allowed you to engage in the dangerous activity in the first place? The answer must be that there are risks we are able to discount, and one of those is a risk which is more distant. I'm allowed to discount a risk that is not in front of me right now. Everyone follow the concept? Right? That risks that are not in front of us right now are taken less strongly in Jewish law. Now, the question is why? If I know that there's a risk, it's just not in front of me right now, why should Jewish law permit me to take it less seriously? It's still a risk. It's still going to happen. So why is it that I can count it as less significant just because it's not in front of me right now?
Because it's less likely to happen.
Less likely to happen. Good. So the argument could be, you think that anything can happen between now and then. So therefore, I'm allowed to engage in the activity that ultimately is going to lead to a risk. Maybe I'll even be able to do something myself in the interim. I'll give you an example, right? Not engaging in daily exercise. Okay? You don't engage in daily exercise day after day after day. Eventually, it's going to come back to bite you. But a lot of people don't do it. Right? Why? Because I can do it tomorrow. Eventually, I will do something that will end up diffusing the risk, right? People who don't floss and they don't floss and they don't floss, and eventually they find out, what do you know? The risk came true. I have gum problems. But they take the risk because they figure, yeah, but it may not happen for any number of reasons. They consider it less significant. And that may be what Jewish law is considering here. The fact that it's less certain, just the fact that its future is automatically less certain. Yes, Rose.
Today, it's not going to affect you this minute, but the long-term effects are enormous, and maybe Jewish law, it's kind of weird, because should Jewish law not look at that as an important factor?
Yes, and the answer is absolutely yes. Now, this is only one piece of a greater calculation, right? It's important to remember that, meaning the calculation of, well, it's far away, therefore I have less concern, doesn't mean automatically I can dismiss it. There's a lot of written material over the last 40, 50 years about smoking in Jewish law, really going back to the 60s, and increasingly against it, despite the fact that it's a distant risk. But yes, being a distant risk is a factor, not the sole factor. Mark has his hand up.
We get the mumps, rubella vaccination, not because we think we're going to get mumps or rubella tomorrow. It might happen years down, but we want to be protected now.
Right.
So I'm just saying there's no immediate, there's no immediate risk. You can say, okay, so we won't worry about it.
Right. But the argument here is, if a risk is less immediate, then indeed it has less weight. I would go further and say it's not only a matter of saying something could happen in the interim, but also that the less specific the information about the harm, the less of a duty I have to intervene and to act in order to prevent that harm. That's a fact, meaning it's a legal statement, but it's also just a basic fact. Consider this. If you have information that there is a man who has, or it doesn't matter, man, I'm not sure why I said that. You have a person who has an STD. They have a disease that can be transmitted through sexual relations. And you know that they have a person who they live with, a spouse, a partner, whatever it is, and you know that they're not telling that person. You have an ethical responsibility, from a Jewish law standpoint, to tell them. Depending on how you came by the information, depending on your relationship, depending on what province you live in, you may have a legal responsibility to actually inform that person. What happens if, instead of knowing this person has a particular partner and that they're not telling that partner, what if you just know that, in general, they're not planning on telling people? Do you have to take out a billboard to inform the public that this person is dangerous? How far does your obligation go? And the answer, without going into that discussion in depth, is that the less specific your information is, the lower your duty, the lower your responsibility is. And the same thing can be said regarding something that's far in the future. But I suspect that the main reason why Jewish law is willing to give less weight to a future harm is because of something that we said last week when we talked about risks that are higher and risks that are lower, which is to say that a lot of the way that Jewish law weighs risk is based on human psychology. If people are concerned about it, it's considered significant. If people are not concerned about it, it's not considered significant. And human psychology is such that we worry less about things that are further away. And maybe partly because, as Marilyn said before, this is something that may not happen, it may not come to pass. But fundamentally, we're less worried about things that are far in the future, and there's even a phrase for it. There's a term for it. The term is horizon-dependent risk aversion. Horizon-dependent risk aversion. Now, I didn't make up the term. Take a look at source number 2 on your sheet. This is a paper from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in 2015 called Anxiety in the Face of Risk. Obviously, in economics, this is a very big deal. So look at this paper. Horizon-dependent risk aversion, the idea that you have greater concern and fear of danger for things that are immediate and less concern over time, is very well documented experimentally. Subjects tend to be more risk averse when a risk is temporarily close. I don't know why they had to say temporarily close. Why couldn't they just say happening soon? Temporarily close is just confusing. Nonetheless, that's what they mean. Subjects tend to be more risk averse when a risk is temporarily close than when it is distant, in both across subject and within subject studies. And he goes through here a bunch of cases. I brought you the first one in the case. Jones, in the first case that he brings, Jones and Johnson have subjects participate in a simulated medical trial for a new drug. Each subject has to decide on the dose of the drug to be administered. So they tell people, you're participating in a clinical trial. It's not true, but that's what they tell people. You're engaged in a clinical trial, and you have to help us decide what dose you're going to take. The subjects are told that the probability of experiencing unpleasant side effects increases with dosage. But so does monetary compensation. We'll pay you more to take a higher dose, but you may have worse side effects. That's great. So more risk-averse subjects should then choose lower doses than less risk-averse subjects, right? If you're risk-averse, you'll say, I'll take the lower dose and not make as much money. You like risk? You'll take the higher dose and take more money. The study finds that subjects choose higher doses when the drug is to be administered the next day than when it is to be administered immediately. Okay? In other words, you sign up today to get the dose tomorrow, you'll sign up for a higher dose. You sign up today to take the dose today, you sign up for a lower dose. We know this is true from our own experience. One of the cases that they bring is skydiving. And people agreeing to go skydiving, but then when they actually are in the plane, they, you know what, I don't think I want to jump. Something that's more immediate tends to be more real to us, and we're less likely to take the risk. Then their reason for it as in the second paragraph in source number 2. While our model uses an expected utility formulation with standard intertemporal lotteries over monetary outcomes, you can ignore the words we just read. The next words are the ones that matter. We find it intuitively plausible that HDRA, horizon-dependent risk aversion, arises due to the effect of emotions on decision-making, and the fact that emotional responses are stronger for more salient cues. In other words, when something is immediate, your emotions about it are stronger. And this is all about people's emotional response to risk. I'm jumping in the source within the second paragraph. Emotional reactions to risk, such as fear and anxiety, increase as the risk draws closer. That's the way they look at it. It's about your gut reaction to the situation. I brought you, actually, you mentioned smoking before, Rose. So if you take a look at source number 3, a paper from a journal called Health Communication talks about how you frame anti-smoking messages. And it basically, what it says, I brought it on the sheet, but I'm not going to read it aloud. You can take a look at it yourself later. I'm putting the link for the source sheet in the chat again in case anybody needs that. But what what this article I quoted in source number 3 says is that they did studies about people's reaction and their commitment to stop smoking when they were told that there's a long-term risk of developing throat cancer, as opposed to when they were told that there was a near-term risk of heart attack. And what they found was people who were told about a near-term risk of heart attack were much more committed to stop smoking. People who were told there's a long-term risk of throat cancer, less committed, more likely to put it off. This is how people respond to risks that they perceive. So, going back to our point and summarizing where we are, what we said last week and then in the beginning of this week is we are required to take steps to protect our health. That includes not entering dangerous situations. We talked about keeping a dangerous dog around. We talked about fencing in drop-off areas around one's property. We are entitled to take risks in order to forestall other risks, like you do when you go to work. How do you decide which risk to take? So we said if one of the risks is so low as to be insignificant, or if the cost of ignoring one of the risks is much greater, you do a cost-benefit analysis, or if both risks are present right now, versus if one of them is more remote. That's basically what we've accomplished. What I want to do now, if you remember the structure I presented in the beginning, I said when you want to deal with ethical issues in Judaism, you start out with your biblical sources, you move into rabbinic discussion, and then you have to figure out, so how does this apply to the case in front of me, which may have nuances? So I want to apply this to vaccines. And you can see on your sheet, after source number 3, I gave you review questions. Feel free to go through those. You can send me your answers, and I'll grade them later. If you don't want to, you don't have to fill it out and send it to me. You can just take your chances on the final. But the question is now, dealing with vaccines, for those who haven't been in my classes before, no, there are no exams. Don't worry. Is this a case... The case that we are dealing with, the vaccine case, is that a case in which it's justified to take the risk? What do we do when you're dealing with vaccines? So the first issue you have to look at is, how sure are you that the vaccine is going to be effective? As was noted last week, we're not even talking about 100% effective. That's not the threshold that we're looking at. How do you know that it's going to be 80% effective? How do you know that this is a risk worth taking? How does Jewish law look at that? So first we come back to a point which came up last week after the discussion, after the class, when I stayed on a few minutes afterwards, we got into this. The first thing you have to recognize is that as far as Jewish law is concerned, scientific information is often uncertain, but we take it seriously anyway. Those who were in my session about a doctor advising a rabbi from Sunday morning heard this conversation already there. I'm going to do it in brief here. We recognize that scientific information is often uncertain. How do you know? Well, the Talmud states, well, first of all, Yeah, I'm going to do it this way. The Talmud records that there is a that God permits doctors to heal patients. Meaning, the Torah describes a situation in which one person attacks another person and causes that person harm. There's a fight. Somebody attacks somebody else and he breaks his arm. The assailant is going to be required to pay for damages. They have to pay five different kinds of damage. Those who like the Hebrew, nezek, tsar, ripui, shevet, boshet. They have to pay for damaging the person and depreciating their value. They have to pay for time lost from work. They have to pay for humiliation they caused. All sorts of different types of harm. One of the things they have to pay is ripui. They have to pay medical bills. Because the Torah says, rak shivto yitain, he shall pay for time lost from work. Virapo yirape. And also, the assailant has a responsibility to heal the victim. So you pay medical bills. And the Talmud says, that's interesting. If the Torah says, pay medical bills, that must mean that there's such a thing as a doctor. The Torah must recognize doctors. Now I know that there is a that doctors are allowed to heal people. And all the commentators read that passage in the Talmud and ask the question that I'm sure many of you are already asking, right? Which is, why do you need permission? Don't we have a principle that says, don't stand by while somebody else is being harmed? Lo samod al dam rayecha, don't stand by while somebody's blood is shed. Obviously, I have a responsibility to heal someone if I'm capable of doing so. Why does the Torah need to teach me permission for healing people? Who needs permission? Isn't it obvious? What would you say?
But isn't there a motto, do no harm?
Yeah. And therefore what?
Do no harm, so the opposite is try to fix.
Yeah. Well, do no harm versus try to fix assumes that there is such a thing as fixing and that fixing is okay.
Well,
right, and you have within Judaism the idea of shev al tasa, that if you're concerned that you might cause harm in a situation, sometimes it may be better to say, you know what, then don't do, right, rather than take a gamble. That is true sometimes. Claire, you were going to say? No? Okay, sorry. Thought so.
One more thing, you do have to make sure, I mean, especially going back in the sources, that they are truly doctors. I mean,
yes, we're getting there. That's coming next. You are right, but we're not there yet. So I think that the one of the key explanations for why we say, why the Torah needs to permit a doctor to heal and not just take it as a given, is because of what Rabbi Avram Yitzchak Cook points out in source number 4. He wasn't the first to say this. Rabbi Moses Nachmanides, also known as Ramban, said it in the 13th century, but I like the formulation Rabbi Cook uses. It's a clearer formulation for the reader, for sure. And that is, doctors don't know everything. And even if you have the most tried and true therapy, something that is standard issue, there are going to be times when it doesn't work. And not only that, there will be times when it backfires. Mistakes happen. Mistakes in diagnosis, mistakes in preparing the medicine, all sorts of things can happen, whether due to lack of knowledge, whether due to just general human imperfection. So take a look at source number 4, where Rabbi Cook says that's the issue here. The simple explanation of the words of the sages when they said, the passage in the Talmud, and he shall heal, from this we see that the Torah permitted a doctor to heal, indicates that the knowledge involved in medicine is uncertain. Were it clear, if doctors were right 100% of the time, how could anyone think there was no obligation to heal? How could you think you weren't obligated? Would one not be violating, do not stand by while others' blood is shed, for not intervening to prevent any trouble which befell a person, even trouble from heaven? Even a lion is from heaven, or a lion attacks somebody, and yet if you see someone being attacked by a lion, you're supposed to try to save them. You don't say, well, God sent the lion. The same thing is true in medical treatment. He says, it's the reason, I'm just looking at a note in the chat, but I'm trying to avoid looking at notes in the chat. The reason why the Torah needs to teach me that, the reason why the Torah needs to teach me that doctors are allowed to heal is because medicine is sometimes unsure. And the point that I want to make from that, from the lack of certainty involved in medical knowledge, the point that I want to use that for is to point out that the Talmud teaches that if somebody is ill on Shabbos and treating them requires violating Shabbos, if they're dangerously ill, it's a life and death situation, then we apply the medical treatment, even though medical information is uncertain. If the doctor says, I think this person must eat on Yom Kippur, and they're endangering their life if they don't, we have them eat on Yom Kippur. Ah, but the doctor's not sure either. Yeah, that's true. Nonetheless, we rely on medical information. So what kind of medical information do we rely on? When you say, make sure the doctor is really a doctor, like how do you know who to rely on? If it's true that it's uncertain, then on what basis do you go? So a few different points. Rambam, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, in writing in the 12th century in Egypt, offered you an approach in source number 5. This is from his Guide of the Perplexed in source number 5. And he writes about it elsewhere as well, but I chose this one. He's talking about what's called in Hebrew Darkei Emori, the ways of the Emorites. The Emorites were a Canaanite nation the Jews met when they arrived in the land of Israel. They actually knew them from before when we had been in there with the patriarchs and matriarchs, but they were there as well when we came in from Egypt. And the Emorites had all sorts of pagan practices that the Torah prohibits. So Rambam, Maimonides, writes in source number 5, the sages said explicitly that therapeutic treatments are not subject to Emorite ways. Medicine is not prohibited as an Emorite way. It's not considered inappropriate, meaning that anything mandated by natural studies is permitted. Anything else is prohibited. Maimonides is distinguishing between medicine on the one hand and superstition on the other. And he says, if it comes from scientific study, then it's not called superstition, and therefore it's not called Emorite ways, and therefore it is, and therefore it's okay. And then he says, not only if it comes from scientific study, but anything proven by experience may be practiced, even where logic does not dictate it. He says, if experience shows that this works, it's acceptable. So Maimonides is trying to distinguish between what you could call quackery and superstition and real medicine. And he gives you two criteria. He says, does it come from scientific study and theory? That's number one. And number two, even if you don't have the theory to explain it, have you seen it work? Is there experience that indicates that this is effective? And that's an approach. Mark, I see your hand. What's up?
But doesn't Halakha go even further and say that if you ask somebody who's ill whether they should eat on Yom Kippur and the doctor says no, when they say yes, that we actually rely on the patient themselves to self-diagnose?
Correct. There's a principle of Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho. The heart knows the bitterness of its spirit. And what that means is that as far as the Talmud is concerned in this particular case and certain other ones, a person is aware of their medical situation to an extent that the doctor may not be. There may be flaws in the diagnostic. Sometimes that happens because the person doesn't report what they're feeling. Sometimes it happens because the report is made in a way that's inefficient or doesn't convey things properly. Sometimes it's because the doctor misses something. But
it could also lead to huge errors. You know, their gut feeling is maybe completely irresponsible.
Correct. So that is much discussed. The assumption in that case that you're talking about is that the patient is someone who's committed to observing the fast, but just feels like they're dangerously ill. Not that the patient just wants an excuse to eat. So they really feel, I'm in danger. And the doctor says, you're okay. I'm sure we are all familiar with, I certainly am familiar with, cases in which someone has gone to a doctor, said something's wrong, and the doctor said, no, you're fine, and later found out that, no, there actually was something wrong. And sometimes it's very serious. The reality is that the diagnostics are not always perfect, and certainly in their day they weren't. So yes, we're assuming everybody is on the same team, and they're trying to keep the fast. And if somebody says, I know the doctor says I can make it, but I know something's wrong, then we listen to them. There is discussion about this, to take your question further, regarding what happens if the doctor prescribes a particular medication or a particular therapy, and the patient thinks they need something else. And the patient is not a medical expert. So then what do you do? And that has its own very interesting ramifications. But the point that we're trying to make here is this. There's a recognition that doctors are not going to be sure. There's a recognition that it's uncertain. So what do I do? Says Maimonides, does it come from scientific theory? Does it come from experience that this is effective? Various commentators tie it to the expertise of the practitioner. How good is the physician you're talking about? If you take a look at source number 6, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, writing in Italy centuries ago, and he's actually quoting an earlier source, he says, you need board certification. He says, today, when no one may treat without license from their scholars meaning the non-Jewish community, the secular community, there's a board that interviews and reviews your training and says, okay, you're able to treat. So all who are involved in treating are called experts. So he says the result of that is anyone who is involved in providing medical treatment, anyone who has that certification, is acceptable. Now, we always want the greatest one possible. I brought you source number 7, Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, who says one should not attempt to heal unless he is expert and no one greater is present. Right? We always want the best doctor possible. He says, otherwise you shed blood. However, if you can't get the greatest, then you get the greatest one available. That's what you do. But fundamentally, we're looking for expertise. That's the basic point. And if you look at source number 8, and then Marilyn, I'll get to your question. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, writing in 18th century Germany, said that even if an unknown treatment is prescribed, that's considered certain if it's authorized by an expert physician. He tells you something you've never seen this before, you don't know it works, whatever. Nonetheless, the expert physician's word is what counts. Marilyn.
Couldn't we say that if you're cured or if you're healthy, it doesn't matter if they're an expert. It could be a naturopath, an osteopath, could be a healer. They don't have to have that expert in front of them. They do have training. It depends if someone, I know people go from consult to consult, and if they get better with somebody, he's wonderful. He's an expert. So it's very complicated.
It is certainly complicated, and what you're pointing to is actually a topic I'm planning on giving a class on in February, not the Wednesday morning series, but my medical series, a class on alternative medicine and how you view something which somebody reports works, but the medical establishment says there's no scientific reason why it should work. What do you do when Maimonides, effectively, in source number 5, his two points are in conflict, where he says, go with your scientific logic, and based on the scientific logic, this should not be effective. But on the other hand says, if it's proven by experience, then it's medicine. And this seems to be proven by experience. What counts as proven by experience is going to be its own discussion. But I'm not going there right now, because it's a massive, massive topic, this alternative medicine issue. But the upshot of this, of saying I rely on proper theory, I rely on tested effectiveness, I rely on the expertise of the practitioner, leads us to say, you go with what is standard medical practice. If this is what doctors are telling people to do, and obviously the application to the vaccine, if they do their trials, they do their studies, and they determine this has 80% effectiveness or whatever the number is, then that's what we accept, and I brought you numerous sources supporting that here. Source number 9, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who was a major authority in Jewish medical ethics in particular in Israel, I mentioned him last week as well, I think, says, the common denominator among the views that he quoted before getting to this paragraph is that so long as the doctor intends to heal via the medical methods he possesses, he is permitted to do so, and it is a mitzvah for him to treat the patient via the accepted medical approach for this illness, whatever the illness is at hand, that's what the doctor is supposed to use. That's the idea. Rabbi Yaakov Reischer in source number 10 says, you get the opinion of the majority of doctors, and he wants a strong majority of 2/3 of doctors supporting it. And then I brought you source number 11, just cause. If you take a look at source number 11, this is from Chabad.org. It is translations of letters written by the Lubavitcher Rebbe regarding vaccination. This obviously goes back decades, and you'll see it's the 1950s, polio vaccine. And he says, when the polio vaccine was being implemented in Israel, there were those who turned to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson of righteous memory, for his opinion. The following is a sampling of his replies. In the winter of 1957, the Rebbe wrote a reply pointing out he was hurrying to do so because of the prime importance of the issue at hand. And here's the quote. Regarding your question about inoculations against disease, I am surprised by your question, since so many individuals from the land of Israel have asked me about this and I've answered them in the affirmative, since the overwhelming majority of individuals do so here in the United States successfully. Understandably, if there are inoculations that are produced by multiple pharmaceutical companies, you should use the ones whose product has been safely tried and proven. Right? That's not a surprise. Another letter from 1956. In reply to your letter in which you ask my opinion about the injections that are commonly given to young children, it is with regard to matters such as these that the axiom, do not set yourself apart from the community, applies. You should act according to that which is done by the parents of the majority of children who are in your children's classes, and goes on to support it. And then again in 1957, he continues to say that when somebody asked him that there were stories about people being harmed by shots that were faulty, he says, the event that occurred in the United States was at the beginning of the use of these vaccines before the exact medical compound was definitively established. This is not the case at present after months of experience with the vaccine. Therefore, once the vaccine's reliability is firmly established, there is no worry, and to the contrary, dot, dot, dot. Now, that leaves open a question. What about being involved in the initial doses, if you really believe that there's a danger? And I want to come back to that in this series. But
wasn't he a scientist?
I don't believe so. He did study briefly at the University of Berlin. I'm not sure how long he was there. Okay. Either University of Berlin, I'm not sure actually which one it was. You can look it up online in terms of
where he was. He took courses at the Sorbonne.
Oh, the Sorbonne, that was it. Thank you. Okay. But based on what we're saying so far, it sounds like traditional vaccines like MMR are to be accepted as effective, and any new vaccine, like for COVID, is going to have to be evaluated along the same lines. But now, even if we say they're effective, let's come back to discuss risk, especially if they're not going to be 100% effective. What do we do about the risks? Now we go back to the principles we articulated about weighing one risk versus the other. Some of the principles are more helpful, some of the principles are less helpful. So the third approach that we gave was that you're willing to accept long-term risk over short-term risk. So here, that's not so relevant unless you're going to say that the risk identified with the vaccine is a long-term risk, right? If someone is worried about effects happening decades down the line, whereas COVID is an immediate risk. So maybe you could make that argument that if the concern with the vaccine is for long-term harm, then I should accept that risk in order to avoid immediate harm. It's possible that you could make that argument. The first approach that we gave, discount risks that are negligible. So negligible means, as we said last week, something that people routinely dismiss. Well, no one dismisses risk of COVID, right? I mean, I shouldn't say no one. There are people who dismiss the risk of COVID. Fine. But that's not standard issue. Generally speaking, people take COVID, the risk of COVID, very seriously. With the vaccine, again, if you're saying that people don't view that as a risk, so then your answer is going to be discount the risk with the vaccine because people normally discount it. On the other hand, if there are real side effects and rates of occurrence for those side effects, then it's not negligible. But what the approach that's strongest here is the approach that says gauge the risks on each side against the other. And the risk of COVID, right, the odds of contracting it vary by location, but the harm if one contracts it, which isn't only the harm to the individual who gets it, but also the people to whom they may communicate it, is severe. The risk with the vaccine, well, remains to be seen. You have to do the tests, determine what the side effects are, and find out. That's why they do trials. But that's how you make your decision regarding the vaccine. You accept the medical establishment saying that something is effective, to whatever rate they determine it is effective. You take seriously the possibility of side effects, and you weigh one risk against the other, short-term versus long-term, negligible versus significant, or higher and lower. Now, there's one other point that I want to mention here. I didn't bring it in the sources, but I wanted to at least mention it. There are people out there who argue that Jewish law opposes vaccination in general, having nothing to do with risk. There is an organization called Enriched Parenting, which has a website. They've actually removed the stuff that I saw there the last time that I spoke about this. I don't know if somebody sent them the link to the recording of the class I gave. But the their website is enrichedparenting.org. I do not recommend it. But they claim that Jewish law opposes vaccination. And their way to do that is by misusing sources and playing logical sleight of hand. So, for example, there is a responsum by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein dealing with using an IV on Yom Kippur to enable fasting. Somebody had asked Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was a major, major authority in Jewish law, probably the leading figure in Jewish law in North America from the 1950s through 1986 when he passed away. He came over from Russia and he was recognized when he was in Russia still as a leading authority. So somebody asked Rabbi Feinstein, if someone has trouble fasting on Yom Kippur, maybe they should get an IV before Yom Kippur, and that way they can get hydration and they can get nutrition and they'll make it through the fast and it's already in before Yom Kippur. So Rabbi Feinstein said no. He says, when the Torah says we license doctors to heal, that refers to healing, not to trying to apply treatments to enable people to fast. If you can't fast, if it's not medically safe for you to fast, you're exempt from fasting. You don't need to get an IV for it, and he says it's inappropriate to get an IV for it. That's Rabbi Feinstein's responsum. The people of enriched parenting use that to say Rabbi Feinstein prohibits invasive preventative medicine, like vaccines. Because he said don't do an IV in order to be able to fast on Yom Kippur, therefore he's against invasive preventative medicine. That's not what he said. Similarly, they play logical sleight of hand in other areas. They say that requiring healthy people to assume risk for somebody else by vaccinating is inappropriate. In other words, if I'm a healthy person and I could take it, whatever the disease is, telling me to vaccinate in order to save somebody else from harm is inappropriate. You can't force me to accept the risk on behalf of somebody else. Now, the truth of the matter is, they're not entirely wrong. We are going to talk about compelling people to vaccinate. And we don't compel people to take a risk on behalf of somebody else. However, when you're dealing with vaccination, number one, it's for the health of the person who receives it. It's not only about other people. And number two, as we will see, there is ample precedent in Jewish law to require taking small risks in order to help others. right? I have an appointment for tomorrow evening to donate blood. I give blood regularly. I take a small risk. Is there a risk? Sure, there's a risk. But it's a very small risk. And go back to what we said about negligible risks and about cost benefit and so forth. And you take small risks for others. We're going to see that. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. Well, in a lot bit, but we'll get to it. The point is that there are people who make arguments like this in the name of Jewish law, but you have to go back to the sources and you have to analyze what they're saying. There's more. They have more material there, and it's equal. You know, it's of the same caliber. I just don't want to spend the entire class debunking enriched parenting. Dahlia, and then Sandy. Dahlia, you're muted.
When they begin to test the virus, somebody has to be brave enough to be in the forefront of trying it.
Yeah, we're getting there.
What do you do?
Yeah.
We want to help the community, but we might be causing harm to ourselves.
So that's something I do plan on getting to in the series, is the topic of how you do trials and the possibility of people even volunteering for challenge trials. That's supposed to be our topic after we talk about compelling people. So I do hope to address that. Sandy, you were going to say?
Actually, it's related to that. They have started clinical trials using young, healthy volunteers.
Right.
Like around 30 years old and younger. And they are volunteering. They are compelled to do this.
There are different kinds of trials, and I want to get to talk about that. It's just not our topic yet. Meaning, there's a difference between a trial where you inject somebody with a vaccine and then have them go about their business, and where you inject someone with a vaccine and you then actually expose them knowingly to the virus, which is what started now in England. But we'll talk about both of those, God willing, just not today. Returning to the vaccine application and the risk versus risk, and how you apply this. So generally speaking, Jewish law has supported vaccine use because it was authorized by doctors who were considered to be in the mainstream. Rav Asher Bush wrote an article. Rav Asher Bush is from New York. He wrote an article about an event that occurred in 1896, in which there was a Jewish man in England who refused a vaccine for his child, and they imprisoned him. And he wrote away to Rabbi Herman Adler, who I think was the chief rabbi, and asked him to defend him, saying, "I don't want to vaccinate my child on religious grounds." And Rabbi Adler refused to defend him. He said, "That's not a justification for failure to vaccinate." And so we see in our own day, you're probably familiar with the famous Wakefield paper that appeared in Lancet, which made the claim linking vaccines to autism, and then researchers spent the next like 20 years trying to debunk this and defeat the effects of the report. The rabbis in their writing on vaccines hastened to point out that that study was discredited. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who was a major authority in medical ethics in Israel until he passed away about 10, 15 years ago, promoted vaccination. Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth, who was a student of Rabbi Orbach, continued to promote it until he passed away a few years ago. Rabbi Asher Bush, in his writing on this, reports conversations with Rabbi Herschel Schachter, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, Rabbi J. David Bleich. They're all uniformly in favor of using vaccines that have been tested and approved by the medical establishment. And I brought you here in source number 12 from 2015, at the time, during one of the measles outbreaks, a statement on vaccinations from the Orthodox Union, also known as the OU, and the Rabbinical Council of America. "Orthodox Jewish parents, like responsible parents across the United States, overwhelmingly vaccinate their children against measles, mumps, rubella, polio, and the other childhood diseases for which inoculations are now almost miraculously commonplace. As in many communities, a small minority of parents chooses not to do so. The ongoing measles outbreak demonstrates how this could bear very serious consequences, not only for their own children, but others too, especially those medically unable to be vaccinated. The Orthodox Union and the Rabbinical Council of America strongly urge all parents to vaccinate their healthy children on the timetable recommended by their pediatrician. So it's taken as a given in most quarters. Yes, there are those who are not on board. As was noted here, in every community, there is always some. But this seems to be consistent, excuse me, with the sources. So that brings us to a topic we're going to start on and then have to complete next week, God willing. And that is compulsory vaccination. Now that you're telling me that Judaism says that people ought to be vaccinating, somebody who says, I don't want to take this risk. Is this person obligated to take the risk for the sake of the community? They're ignoring the risk to themselves. Even though we've said you're responsible to guard your health, we gave multiple sources for that last week. Nonetheless, let's say the person says, I don't want to. What is the rule about vaccinating to prevent the harm to the community? Is there such a duty? So does anybody know Canadian law on this? Anybody know?
You could associate the mask with the same thing with people who refuse to wear a mask, and yet it's just, I don't know if there's a law. Well, it is. It's mandated here, isn't it?
Well, it is and it's not. It is unless you get an exemption.
I believe it's not the law. However, school boards can mandate it.
So take a look at source number 13, please. This is from the Government of Canada. Is immunization mandatory in Canada? Immunizations are not mandatory in Canada. However, in Ontario and New Brunswick, proof of immunization is required for children and adolescents to attend school. In these same provinces, exceptions to immunizations can be made only for medical, can require a note from a healthcare provider, or ideological reasons. So a child may well get the exemption and be able to attend school without immunizing. In the event of outbreaks, children who are not immunized may be asked to stay home from school, childcare, or other organized activities until the outbreak is over, which can often take several weeks. So it's possible for them to get out of the immunization expectation, even in provinces where the school board is empowered to require it. Why is it not simply required? If this is what standard medical advice is, why isn't it required in cases other than a medical exemption?
It has to do with constitutional rights, I believe.
But why is there a constitutional right to go without this?
I don't know why lots of things.
No, but I'm asking, in all seriousness.
They get it against their constitution, they don't have to.
I think it's religious freedom. Security of the person.
What does security of the person mean? Dr. Kirshen?
You have to ask a lawyer. I have no idea.
So there's a basic principle which I think has to be understood here, which is, and this goes to the security of the person point, a little bit towards the religious freedom one, but basically really the security of the person point, which is fundamentally there is a risk. We've acknowledged that there is a risk. You can't pretend that there isn't. And compelling people to take a risk is something that democratic societies in general are not comfortable with. And that's largely why you stop there. Right? That's largely why you stop with that. Keep in mind as well, something we haven't really discussed, although I noted it last week, that even a small risk is substantive when you're dealing with millions of people, right? Even if you'll say, but there's only the one in a million that I mentioned before, right? Even if you say it's only one in a million, okay, and if we're vaccinating 30 million people, right? I'm just talking Canada. Now that means that 30 people are going to get this. I can't point to which ones, but how can I mandate that somebody expose themselves to that risk? And that's why you end up not requiring this, especially if it's for the sake of protecting somebody else.
Okay. And yet we were much more intrusive in the smallpox era and in the polio era.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember receiving the polio vaccine, although my parents signed consent, when I was in grade school.
Right. So my answer to that would be that the views of rights and responsibilities have evolved over time. We are living in an age which highly emphasizes the rights of the individual over the needs of the community. And I could apply that to a whole host of cases, but we have 4 minutes left.
But it doesn't emphasize the responsibility of the individual.
Correct. And that's where I wanted to go with this. That's where I wanted to go with it. Mark, you were going to say?
I believe there's a lot more tolerance for society if somebody really objected, if there's herd immunity out there. If 90% already have it, okay, we're not going to force it, as opposed to 20%.
Right. The problem is all these people are volunteering to be in the 10% or whatever it is, and, you know, herd immunity itself, in terms of what you need, is debated. But the point for us is this. From a secular perspective, the answer seems to be the government does not wish to compel people to take risks on behalf of the community around them. Jewish law, on the other hand, is very comfortable with the idea that you have a greater responsibility to the community, and therefore you do take risks in order to take care of others. You can look in the Torah for biblical models of this, right? Abraham goes to war against the four kings in order to save his brother-in-law Lot. Esther endangers herself for the community, going to King Ahasuerus. But it's hard to work with biblical examples. Because when you're working with biblical examples, there's always the feeling of, yeah, but they know they're getting a miracle. They're there in the Bible. You know, they have a different relationship with God than I do. So maybe not. But take a look at source number 14. I've already referenced this source before. How do we know that one who sees another drowning in a river, being dragged by a beast, or being beset by bandits must act to save him? And the answer is, the Torah says, you shall not stand by as the blood of your brother is shed, or the blood of another is shed. Lo sa'amod al dam re'echa. Verse from Leviticus, which we referred to before. Tell me something. Do you imagine that the Talmud is saying that you can save someone from being dragged by a beast or beset by bandits without any risk to yourself? Who are they talking to? Right? Are they talking to, like, Goliath, that he can just walk in and fight off the bandits and there's no risk of harm to him unless someone has a slingshot? There's always risk in intervening for somebody else, and yet we are told that there's a responsibility. Now, if you can't help, or if you're highly vulnerable, then you lose that responsibility. And that's its own discussion. However, fundamentally, if I am able to help, then I am supposed to take on a level of risk. So what I want to do is pick up with that, God willing, next week, to talk more about this issue of responsibility to the community, as well as the question of whether Jewish law would truly require that somebody take a risk for the community, that somebody vaccinate if it's just for the sake of helping other people. And then I want to move from that conversation into some of the other questions that people have been asking. The question of clinical trials and volunteering for a trial in which you take a much greater risk in order to save others, as well as the question of triage and how you decide who should be getting the vaccine first. So we have a lot to talk about. We got 2 weeks left, and hopefully we'll be able to do justice to some of these topics. Thank you once again, and I'm going to stay on for a few minutes afterwards, but I wanted to let everybody out on time. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Well, we're going to catch up with you this week, so don't worry.